Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. If you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get ad-free versions of every episode of the podcast. We hope you'll come engage with other listeners to talk about what's new, old, and interesting in film. You can find it all at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha Robinson, our co-host, is off getting bedazzled somewhere in the deep south, but we will see her again on a future episode. This week, we almost certainly say goodbye to the summer of 2001, at least as far as studio movies are concerned. We did AI, artificial intelligence, earlier this year in a pairing with After Yang, and today we tackle Moulin Rouge. I, of course, will resist any effort to give Shrek the classic designation, which leaves Pearl Harbor, Evolution, Swordfish, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, Dr. Dolittle 2, the first Fast and the Furious movie, Cats and Dogs, Jurassic Park 3, America's Sweethearts, and Planet of the Apes. There's also Legally Blonde, which I think we more or less like. So any arguments from you, Keith or Genevieve, about closing the book on the blockbusters of 2001 after today?
I'm not ready to write off Legally Blonde as an option in the future. I'm holding on to that. We may do Legally Blonde.
Yeah, I did kind of want to separate that one from the rest of the bunch. Keith, is that all right with you?
That's fine. Yeah, and I will say I remember Dr. Dolittle 2, I think, has a fairly sensitive vocal performance from Albert Brooks as a tiger. I don't know. I can look it up, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But that's actually, I mean, I wrote something about this on the review. It's not a great summer, although we certainly have found a couple of great movies with at least one in reserve. But yeah, and Jurassic Park 3, I think, is enjoyable, but probably nothing we need to feature on the show.
It's fine. I honestly wish there were more. I think we talked about this on the show. Like, if they want to do more stuff like Jurassic Park 3, just like do dinosaurs eating people for 90 minutes or whatever, that's fine. Just, you know, keep it tight. Still, amid this dire summer of sequels, remakes, and franchise starters, we also got Baz. And we're getting Baz again in the summer of 2022. Genevieve, what's our pairing for this set of episodes?
This week, we're visiting turn-of-the-century Paris, where artists, dancers, and dramatists once thrived in the bohemian paradise of the Moulin Rouge, a cabaret that heralded a more liberated age. With Moulin Rouge, Australian director Baz Luhrmann dispenses with the fuddy-duddy conventions of historical drama and instead crafts a jukebox musical about love and creative freedom, with a soundtrack full of recognizable pop hits. Luhrmann's fevered style and irreverent approach to history also figures into his new film Elvis, an Elvis Presley biopic that seeks to remind audiences why he was such a phenomenon.
So in this episode, we'll talk about Moulin Rouge and how it captured a pop culture moment. And then next week, we'll bring in Elvis, which revives a king that may be dead, at least for the younger generations. Please stay with us.
He entered a world where fantasy is real, where he could be anything he wanted, and where he would discover the most dangerous temptation of all.
Come and get me, boys. Diamond! Are a girl's best friend.
I believe you were expecting me.
Yes. Silly, think you would fall in love with someone like me.
I can't fall in love with anyone. I make men believe what they want to believe.
Never knew I could feel like this.
I believe in truth, freedom, and above all things, love.
Like I've never seen.
You're gonna be bad for business. I can tell.
Roxanne! I am willing to provide the financial resources to make you a star.
You don't have to wear that dress tonight. I require a contract that binds Satine to me exclusively.
He could destroy everything.
I don't care. We have each other.
Among a certain subset of film critics, the release of Moulin Rouge was an apocalyptic moment, starting with its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival in France, which felt like returning to the scene of the crime. The most celebrated of all French filmmakers, Jean Renoir, had already made his Moulin Rouge movie, French Can-Can, half a century earlier, and the deft sensuality of his work couldn't be further removed from Baz Luhrmann, whose aggressive montage style struck some as unseemly vulgarization. In The Village Voice, Jay Hoberman called Moulin Rouge, quote, a voracious vacuum cleaner of a movie, hoovering up 100 years worth of junk with the same monotonously unmodulated hum. In Slate, David Edelstein said, quote, it's meaningless to criticize Moulin Rouge for being florid, campy, and excessive, since Luhrmann aspires to make his audience drunk on florid, campy excess. The real problem isn't overload, but emptiness. The audience stays stone-cold sober. Moulin Rouge was a hit with audiences, however, despite falling well outside any formula for what a surefire summer blockbuster might look like. Luhrmann had successfully cultivated a young audience for Shakespeare 5 years earlier with his gangland modernization of Romeo and Juliet, so the expectation was that he could do so again with another tragic romance with a hip contemporary flavor. In the lead-up to the film's release, MTV laid the groundwork for the experience with a music video for the cover of Lady Marmalade. Christina Aguilera, Lil' Kim, Maya, and Pink all did the cover in the video, along with Missy Elliott, who produced the single. And the sultry choreography was a taste of what Moulin Rouge would be like, even though the video wasn't directed by Luhrmann himself. But the MTV aesthetic was nonetheless a big part of the film's appeal, and a key source of the hostility directed toward it. Large chunks of Moulin Rouge unfold in sequences rather than traditional scenes, held together by a soundtrack that mixes and matches seemingly incongruous songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit and the aforementioned Lady Marmalade. Luhrmann seems to have internalized the way young people can ride a wave of different pop, rock, and hip-hop singles without finding the experience jarring. Edelstein was right to say that Luhrmann wants the audience drunk on florid, campy excess, and he was willing to experiment radically in film language in order to make that happen. Australian cinema has a tradition of gonzo, go-for-broke entertainment, and Luhrmann is bringing that energy to Hollywood. At the same time, Moulin Rouge does benefit from certain conventional hooks, like the star charisma of two A-list actors, and a swooning, tragic love story as old as, well, Romeo and Juliet. Ewan McGregor stars as Christian, a penniless writer who's drawn to the bohemian splendor of the Moulin Rouge like a moth to flame. Soon after his arrival, he teams up with a troupe led by Toulouse-Lautrec, played by John Leguizamo, that's working on a play called Spectacular Spectacular. They want their star attraction to be the star attraction at the Moulin Rouge. Her name is Satine, aka the Sparkling Diamond, a courtesan played by Nicole Kidman. The ringmaster of the Moulin Rouge, Harold Zeidler, played by Jim Broadbent, wants Spectacular Spectacular to launch a brand new theater, but he needs money to make it happen. For that, Zeidler turns to the Duke, played by Richard Roxburgh, who agrees to bankroll the production with one major string attached. He's infatuated with Satine and wants her included in the deal. Lots of romantic complications follow once Christian and Satine fall in love and carry out their affair in secret, and Satine starts coughing blood into a handkerchief in the first reel, so you know she'll be in trouble by the last. Luhrmann milks this love triangle for physical comedy and farce, as Christian and Satine have to improvise to cover their relationship. And he also expresses their love with full visual and audio splendor, drawing on recognizable hits like Elton John's Your Song, Wings' Silly Love Songs, and David Bowie's Heroes, while the moon smiles and confetti rains down from the sky. Moulin Rouge was an overwhelming cinematic experience in 2001. That's something its fans and detractors can agree on. You'll see how we stand on it after the break.
Show will be a magnificent, opulent, tremendous, stupendous, gargantuan bedazzlement. A sensual ravishment.
It will be
spectacular, spectacular. No words in the vernacular can describe this great event. You'll be dumb with wonderment. Returns are fixed at 10%. You must agree that's excellent.
and on top of your feet, you'll be in all that history.
So, flashback, if you can, to the summer of 2001. Did Moulin Rouge feel like a watershed moment to you when it came out? Can you remember how you reacted to it? Because for me, you know, and again, my sort of cinephile friends, it was a serious lightning rod.
I kind of had the same experience watching it this time as I had it the first time. I'll say right ahead, right, you know, up top, I like this movie a lot, but there are moments when I'm starting, you know, watching the beginning of it, all the sort of the Looney Tunes stuff with the acting company. It's like, is this movie actually awful? And then like the next scene, I'm like, is this movie actually the best movie I've ever seen? It's just kind of all over the place. Because I do really love like the first Moulin Rouge scene so much. And I think ultimately I land somewhere in the middle, closer to the top. I do like this film quite a bit. It is it's completely out of control in many ways, but I think it's the learning filmography, not to get ahead too much. I this and Romeo and Juliet are by far my favorites. And I think they're the two places where his sense and emotional extremes make sense for the material more than any other subsequent thing he's done, or even Strictly Ballroom for that matter. But you know, when it works, it works. I think it works here.
I was really hesitant to come back to Moulin Rouge because while I can't really speak to my reaction in 2001 from like a cinephile perspective, I wasn't really hanging out with a lot of cinephiles at that point. And I actually don't even remember seeing this in the theater. I'm sure I did because I really loved Romeo and Juliet as a teenager, and I'm sure I would have been prompted to do. Plus, I watched TRL all the time, so I'm sure I knew the mm-hmm. song. Like, I know I saw this in the theater, but my associations with it are not that theatrical release. They're the fall in year after when it was on DVD, and which happened to be my freshman year in college, and when I had a Columbia House subscription and that I got DVDs from. And you better believe Moulin Rouge was one of the first DVDs I had in college when we had movie nights. And this was before streaming. We had to, you know, watch what we had, and we watched Moulin Rouge a lot. Like, I realized watching again this time, like, I still have every vocal run from Come What May, like, internalized. Like, I could sing them all. I won't because I'm not that good of a singer, but I know them all. So, like, this movie is, like, in my blood to a certain extent. But I haven't rewatched it in probably 15 years, and in that time have become much more aware of some people's feelings about this movie and have also, you know, maybe arguably developed a bit in my own tastes. So I was afraid to come back to Moulin Rouge a little bit and discover that, you know, those parts that Keith is talking about, you know, maybe this is an awful movie, maybe that would, you know, outweigh everything for me. But nope, I still love this movie. I maybe love it even more now. I feel like it is remarkable, like, how modern this still feels. Like, I feel like this predicted where we are in entertainment in a lot of ways now. Like, the fragmentation and the mashup and the self-reflexiveness. Like, I think you could draw kind of a straight line from Elephant Love Medley to the mid-aughts mashup culture to like TikTok songs today, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, Boz knew what he was doing. And I think that this movie plays really well today. And like, yeah, I get what you're saying, Keith, like that Looney Tunes, like farcical slapstick Hills Are Alive sequence, like, it's weird. It's a really weird way to start a movie, especially like on the heels of this very tragic, sad framing device where we're being told that this is a tragic love story, shades of Romeo and Juliet. But that first Moulin Rouge scene, like, I cried. Like, I've talked before about how I get spectacle tears. And like, that scene is like the epitome of what will induce spectacle tears in me. I just like, I was so happy to be back in that space. And yeah, I mean, I get why people resist this movie. My husband was someone who resisted this movie for a long time, but you know what? He loved it too. So so maybe you just need to get past your hangups.
He resisted just straight up just seeing it, period. Is that what I... Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you hit on something when you talk about how Baz... I think we can call him Baz here. You don't need to see Lerman. How Baz sort of saw the future a little bit. And I feel like that was part of the resentment towards the movie. It was like, okay, I see the future. I don't like it. I mean, in a way, it's, you know, the style of the film is not that dissimilar to a Michael Bay, whose films I genuinely dislike and still dislike, but in that it's really about, you know, montage. It's about visceral impact. It's not necessarily about using the traditional filmmaking tools or traditional filmmaking style, where you're kind of establishing space and you're, you know, I mean, it really has to do with a certain kind of feel, as I said in the keynote, kind of directing in sequences oftentimes rather than scenes. And even the scenes themselves, when we get them, can be, you know, quite manic and full of little curlicues and weird bits of style in themselves. So, you know, so I think it's a matter of how you can just process this kind of intense input. All of that said, I reacted to this film now as I kind of did in 2001. And I think it's pretty similar to Keith. I wanted to run away during that. When John Leguizamo makes his appearance, and I really hate that performance. And I can't get on board with any of it. Mm-hmm. So any of the stuff involving Toulouse-Lautrec and that troop, you know, I would love to just scuttle all of it, because it does not work for me. And that weird little lisp thing he does is not funny. And it hurts. It's painful to watch. And yet, you know, you do get past it, and you've got a lot of movie left to savor, and, you know, you can't help but be swept up in it. I mean, it's a movie that cleverly sort of harnesses the power of the sort of pop music that it's channeling, you know, in this relationship between Christian and Satin. But then also that first sequence that we're talking about, that introduction to the Moulin Rouge, the incorporation of those two songs of Smells Like Teen Spirit and Lady Marmalade, I mean, it's kind of irresistible. It all comes together. It's almost like discovering a new food, you know, like when you put two ingredients together, it's like, that's not going to go together. Don't even try to put that stuff together. And then you put it together, it's like this, you've invented some sort of fusion food. I give you 3 Michelin stars for that. So it's like that kind of experience to watch that first sequence. And it also kind of gives you your first introduction to Jim Broadbent as Ziegler, and that and Nicole Kidman's performance. Those are my 2 favorite performances in the movie. I think he's just so terrific, so diabolical and yet lovable, and the comedy that we get from him is, again, so much stronger than what we get from Leguizamo and his more overtly comic bunch.
I don't hate Leguizamo in this movie, because I just generally like Leguizamo, but he can go a little big, and certainly he's not holding back here. But it seems to, as much as I, you know, also cringe at those opening moments, I it does seem to fit the style of it as well. Also, I mean, I'm also kind of,
it's audacity, this is, points too. Sorry to interrupt, but like when as soon as you realize they're doing The Sound of Music, it's like, wait, what's happening here? You know, like, even like, you kind of like get hints of what's gonna happen with the music before, with the Nature Boy opening, but like when it's just full on doing Sound of Music in Fin de Siècle Paris, like, it's audacious, you know, and I think it primes you for what is about to happen with that Moulin Rouge can-can sequence.
I also, and this is outside the frame of the film, so Scott, cover your ears, but I also find it kind of poignant knowing that Lautrec dies the next year. I mean, this is, you know, not in any way addressed in the film, but like, if you bring a little bit of extra into it, I think that casts it in a different light too. I mean, I find this film weirdly poignant for reasons beyond the tragic love story. Just the idea of, you know, at the end of, or the beginning of one century, you know, reflecting on it's filled with all the songs of the century to come from these people who are kind of, you know, forging out, you know, doing the groundwork for what that century is going to look like. And I really liked your point, Genevieve, about it being forward-looking as well. So I feel like it's kind of came a focal point for a couple of different centuries worth of pop music, ultimately, in some ways.
Is there some kind of incongruity between, you know, the bohemian ideals that are kind of expressed in the film and expressed by the characters, and, say, something from The Sound of Music? For example, or some of these other songs that are used or not exactly, you know, counterculture classics or anything like that.
No, but I think it is kind of, it's an omnivorous approach to popular mm-hmm. music. And I think that's part of what makes it work. You know, Sound of Music, you know, next to, you know, well, more specifically Lady Marmalade next to Smells Like Teen Spirit. Those songs, like you said, don't go together, yet now they go together. And I think if it were to narrow it in some way, it wouldn't necessarily be as interesting a film.
And I think it's also, you know, worth considering that we're only hearing lines and snippets of these songs. You know, there's very few songs. I don't know if there are any pop music songs that we hear beginning to end more than just like a few lines of. Maybe Your Song is the exception there. But, you know, for the most part, we're just getting these decontextualized, kind of iconic lyrics, you know, that have become timeless and are being used in a way that highlights their timelessness and their kind of lack of specificity when you take them out of the context in which they were recorded. Like, these are, you know, big, broad ideas about love, truth, beauty, and shoot, what's the last one?
Freedom.
Freedom, of course. Thank you. So, like, I think it's less about, you know, reminding you of, you know, who originally performed these songs and what they were about and the context in which these songs were made, and more just like kind of triggering that piece of your brain that just knows them on like a bone deep level. And these lyrics that I think, like, on a lyrical level, like the lyrics that are chosen, they all align with what the movie is trying to do.
In the context of the movie, you know, these are characters who are, you know, when Christian starts singing or even speaking lyrics from you know, what to us are recognizable pop songs, they're new to Satine, right? In order to get that. Mm-hmm. But so there's an interesting thing to, in the sense that, like, the power for us as viewers is that these songs are songs we've heard many times before, this incredibly mm-hmm. popular songs, and they have very strong associative qualities. But of course, then we're watching them being presented to her as new, this sort of jumble. And I don't know if there's anything to that or not.
Well, they're being presented as poetry, not as pop songs, you know. Yeah. And again, it's really honed in on the lyrics rather than the whole of the song. You know, it is a very sort of cherry picking approach to musical history, of course, but fine. You know, like, I think that is the film's project, and it doesn't bother me.
And I do think, again, you know, talk about the way this film sort of anticipates a lot of things to come. I mean, of course, it's not, you know, just the aesthetics of it, but I think the way that we experience music now is so much anticipated by this movie in a way that that wasn't so clear to us in 2001 when we were, you know, still, you know, buying records and CDs and listening to full albums and I think there's the way that younger people are kind of getting their musical education now is so much more piecemeal, so much more singles driven, and, you know, you can kind of handle you can handle a mix like this, you can handle Nirvana next to Patti LaBelle or whatever, it all works. So kind of credit this movie for kind of recognizing that it's all kind of one big sort of pop machine.
Just out of curiosity, are either of you familiar with the musical, the stage musical of Moulin Rouge?
No, did you see it?
No. What do they do with it?
I mean, I haven't seen it live. I would like to, and I would very much like to hear from any of our listeners who have seen it, but I have listened to some of the cast recording, and to kind of what we're talking about, I wanted to just note that the Elephant Love Medley, which is what the mashup of silly love songs that they sing in the Elephant is called, the Broadway musical version of that has maybe half a dozen more songs in it, including, let's see, Don't Speak, I Love You Always Forever, Love Hurts, Love is a Battlefield, Such Great Heights, Torn, Take on Me. It takes an even broader approach to sort of inclusivity, the musical inclusivity there. And of course, I've only heard the song in a vacuum, and I'm sure it probably plays great on stage in the house, but I don't really like it with all those, you know, like it feels like it is maybe pushing it a little too far. So I feel like maybe that's kind of me relating to how some people felt maybe in 2001, hearing that for the first time. Like it's like, whoa, yeah, settle down. This is too much.
Yeah. Well, you're right. Yeah. Please. It doesn't have the like restrained Lerman approach. <Yeah. laughs> it's a little out of control, but I can see that. I mean, because, well, and also I think it's proportionally fine. I mean, I don't think you know when this movie works, it really, really works, and that's a really fine sequence. And I didn't experience thinking oh, they've left out a bunch of other songs with love in them. They left out a bunch of other love songs that I would have liked to have heard. I don't think that I guess I would have wanted Love as a Battlefield. I have a soft spot for that one, but it's fine as is. But I guess if you're gonna expand this into a Broadway show, that's gonna presumably, you know, even be more of a musical than this is, then you're gonna have to have that, some of that stuff in there.
Sure.
To parallel this, should the Broadway show, shouldn't it open with like with a movie screen or something instead of theater curtains? Or
yeah, I mean it might. Just kind of briefly note like this point in Baz Luhrmann's like history, did this being called like the Red Curtain Trilogy come across, like I don't know if that's like just how they were marketing it as a DVD.
I think that was a later idea, because I don't think Strictly Ballroom really fits in with Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge as well as, but you know, you got to sell those DVDs.
I guess the way that Luhrmann explained it is that it's like each of the three films is dedicated to a different performing art, dance in Strictly Ballroom, poetry and language in Romeo and Juliet, and musical performance here.
All right.
This wasn't like a Pee Wee Herman, I meant to do that type of moment. Like, got to the third and it's like, wait a minute, I can just tie all this stuff together.
Be that, but I think like the fact that he thought of it that way kind of just speaks to what interests Luhrmann as a film. Like, there's not a thematic connection necessarily between these movies. It's, you know, style. I actually haven't seen Strictly Ballroom. It's not quite as flashy stylistically, right?
Right.
Yeah. But it's more, I guess, just like idea or concept driven, you know? Obviously, there's no like narrative connection between any of them.
I predict that you will really like Strictly Ballroom, by the way.
I think I'm definitely going to revisit Romeo and Juliet because Steve hasn't seen that and has expressed an interest in it. So obviously I'm going to accommodate that. But
That's another one where it was kind of a fight or flight opening for me, where it's like, oh boy.
You were a 15-year-old who really liked Leonardo DiCaprio.
Like right away, like the very beginning of the movie, I think it begins with a lot of gang violence-y stuff, and it doesn't really get to that like super soft Romeo, you know, like that relationship I get, you know, I haven't seen it since it came out, but I recall the beginning of the movie being off-putting in the same way that the beginning of Moulin Rouge is off-putting, and then you just kind of get, you know, won over by it eventually, or worn down, or whatever it is that Luhrmann does. I mean, think about him as like, it just seems like he has a certain kind of instinct in terms of the way he likes to make movies, and his judgment can be kind of questionable at times. There's kind of a wildness to all of his work, and almost a lack of taste, sort of, you know. And I don't mean it to be terribly insulting.
Lack of restraint, maybe.
When I say you're ugly, I don't mean ugly. I mean,
it's restraint. I don't even think it's that, though, because I like, there's stuff of his work that I like. I mean, I like when he's unrestrained. But it also goes along with unrestrained stuff I don't like. So there's inevitably stuff from all of his movies that I wish were, you know, gone, not there, or sequences that you know, make me roll my eyes or want to like move forward. And then others where I'm just utterly enchanted and there's no way of, you know, he just doesn't have that ability to kind of, well, I guess appeal to my specific taste. I don't know. to just weed out, you know, take the bad stuff out, Baz, and keep the good stuff. Anyway, so one question that I did have, you know, because there are so many anachronisms, you know, infused into Moulin Rouge,
anachronisms?
Well, yes. Okay, there are some things that, hey, you know, you're right. Some things we recognize from today that are in 1900 Paris. So they're infused in the Moulin Rouge, into the film quite a bit. What about the actual time and place remains? What is interesting to Lerman about the actual Moulin Rouge and what it represents, and you know, what about this time and place do you feel like he was trying to kind of evoke here?
I mean, I think the anachronisms are what evoke what's interesting to him about it. Like, to go back to that first Moulin Rouge sequence that we've already talked about a bunch, like, you know, just setting aside the music cues of it all, like, just on a filmmaking level, like, it is a chaotic sequence. Like, the sound mix is all over the place, the visuals are swirling, and it's just, you know, you don't really have a sense of grounding, you know, it's just like flying through this moment, and it's loud, and it's colorful, and it's debaucherous. And I think, like, you know, with historical films in particular, we kind of grown accustomed to like compartmentalizing them as like not like our modern life, you know, and different from our modern experience. But that Moulin Rouge scene, like, that feels like being in a club, that feels like being on a dance floor, it feels like being in a debaucherous setting. And I think that moment in time, that bohemian moment, is something that he's trying to make us feel on a modern scale, you know, and not necessarily on a like an intellectual level. He wants us to feel what it felt like to be in that moment. And that comes through in the anachronisms, which, like the music and the filmmaking style and the sort of modern performances we see. And I think it really works. Like, I think, like, it's not really interested in the facts of history, which I'm sure we will get into with Elvis as well, but the feeling of history. And I think it captures that really well.
Yeah, there's this idealized version of bohemian Paris, but I think it's interesting that central to the film is this conflict between commercialism and art, and you know, the haves and the have-nots, but also, like, very specifically, this idea to, you know, the obviously the Duke has other designs, but he's also a meddling film executive in some ways, demanding the film reflect what he wants, and he's the one putting up the money, so you have to deal with it too. I mean, it's not just an idealized bohemia; it's got some not pleasant parts to it as well.
Can I say share one of my favorite things about the Duke, which is that not only does he live in a Gothic tower, but he calls it my Gothic tower. I feel like that just, like, really kind of encapsulates what this movie is doing as far as its self-reflexiveness.
Yeah, one thing about that, one small thing, if we're talking about the historic Moulin Rouge, is the clientele. I mean, that you have. One kind of unforgettable part of that opening is the way you have these sort of gentlemen who have who have the money to be at this club, and they're dressed the way they're dressed. The way they kind of recite the lyric, it almost has this sort of Pink Floyd, The Wall type quality to it. Here we are now, entertain us. It's all this kind of like, it's all, there's almost something kind of almost disturbing quality.
And they're like encroaching like a phalanx, I can never say that right.
Yeah.
The way they're like encroaching on the camera, sinister, and I think it's supposed to be.
It is a tension that is Keith notes is key to the movie, about art and commerce and what these characters want to do and want to express, and what the market demands. How, say, someone like Satine may view herself as a performer, and the way, you know, these gentlemen may be viewing her, and I think that's kind of an important element of the film as well. You know, and Richard Roxburgh, of course, is a really big part of that, and a lot of actors are a really big part of that. So I want to really dig into the performances in this movie because they're all so interesting. Why don't we do that after the break? So lots of fine performances in this movie, as you mentioned, with, you know, we can agree to disagree a little bit on Leguizamo. I don't know, there's a spectrum here on that, but I wanted to start with the lead performances. What did you think of Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman both together and apart in this film?
I think there's just a stretch where Nicole Kidman could just do no wrong, basically. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this like late 90s, early 2000s is just, I'm going to call it the actual run here. You know, from Eyes Wide Shut, Moulin Rouge, The Others, which I just rewatched. I mean, mm-hmm. that's three great ones in a row. Birthday Girl, well, The Hours, and all right. Well, okay, it's a good, but it's a really good stretch, and you know, not all those ones immediately after.
Go
that
back
stretch.
A little bit before you get to Die For. I guess a 95 would be not to Die For.
But yeah, yes. And The Portrait of a Lady is a film I need to revisit.
Oh yeah, she's good.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't really care for the adaptation at the time, but perhaps now I would. So, but yeah, no, I mean, she was just kind of in a zone there for a little while. It's not like she's bad now, but this is just a particularly high point in her career, I think.
And it's a role that requires just so much flexibility. Like, again, to go back to the elephant scene, when the first sort of mistaken identity, when she's supposed to be meeting with the Duke and it's Christian, and then there's all this, you know, kind of farce stuff that happens, but then, you know, it turns into this swooning love moment, you know, a few moments later. It's like kind of hard to track like where that scene ends and begins. I guess it's to Scott's mm-hmm. point about it being more sequences, but like Satine like just has to do so many different types of kind of performing and a little bit of earnestness in there, whereas Christian, who I still like, I really love this performance from Ewan McGregor, but Christian as a character is a lot more straightforwardly earnest throughout the whole film. Like he's not working on sort of these levels of like performance within a performance, sometimes within another performance that Satine has to, or Nicole Kidman has to as Satine. So I think it's like maybe a little more impressive just on a craft level, but I really love Ewan McGregor's voice in the songs here more than Nicole Kidman's, which I don't have a problem with. It's just like, you know, not my favorite, but Christian as a character is like someone who should annoy me, and maybe he does a little bit, but I think McGregor is just sort of floppy haired charisma at this point really saves that character.
Yeah, he is good, and the voice is good, and there's an earnestness and also kind of a slight playfulness to the performance that makes it work. But I guess
at the end he does have some like real like rage and sorrow too. You know, it's not that he has like only one emotional register. It's more just that like he doesn't have to flip back and forth between them. I mean,
the problem is like is that Kidman is just unbelievably good in this movie. You know,
those Marilyn Monroe squeals alone, like, yeah. I mean, it's just kind of perfectly
those are great.
How?
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, as Genevieve said, I mean, she has to do so much in that sequence where we first are in the whatever elephant, you know, because she is performing for both of these gentlemen, first for Christian and then for the Duke. And then she is responding. She has to react to Christian, who is a much more disarming, you know, an intriguing person than she believes, because of course she's thinks that he's someone else, and then she has to engage in comic business, and I think that Kidman is so good at that, like she's really funny, and I think there's mm-hmm. I think that kind of physical comedy, I mean, it's broad, you know, it's something that you could certainly fail at and look absolutely ridiculous in doing it, but she doesn't. She's really deft, and the movie needs that, and and I think we end up caring for her more because of it, because, you know, otherwise the reasons that we have to care for her are already just written into the script, which is that she's dying of consumption and she's this sort of, you know, tragic heroine. Here we can see this other side. to her, this something a little livelier. She has this ability to improvise. She has the ability to be, you know, an artist in the same way that everybody else is, and that's all in Kidman's performance. So I think it's a real, you know, that scene alone, just a real masterpiece of acting there.
Well, and then Jim Broadbent enters the sequence too in it, and then we get the whole like them pitching spectacular, which is a fun little sequence in itself. But yeah, I think like Broadbent is the other sort of leg of the tripod holding up this film on a performance level, and like he plays it in such a way that you never really read Zidler as a villain, which he absolutely is. You know, at least like in,
he's a survivor though, more than
sure,
a villain.
Yeah, I mean he's a more, I maybe villain is too strong a word, especially when we have the Duke in the mix, but he's not a, you know, he doesn't necessarily have Satine's best interests in mind, you know, and he's
a creature of his environment.
Yes, but you absolutely see why Satine and everyone else in the Moulin Rouge is like so attached to him, you know, like he's just a, he fills up a room as both a character and an actor.
Best Jim Broadbent line reading is it everything's going, so well, or is it when he is explaining to the Duke the lyrics to the Madonna song Like a Virgin?
That Like a Virgin sequence, I had kind of forgotten about it. Like I remembered the song was in there, but I forgot how bizarre it is. And again, like sinister and frightening more than you necessarily realize at first from how, you know, silly it seems, which again is kind of what Broadbent's whole thing is. But also, like Richard Roxburgh is the Duke, like obviously doing a much more mustache twirling. Does he literally twirl his mustache at any point? I feel like he must, right?
He must.
Yeah. But like there's elements of silliness there too. Like when he's a little bit funny, like that thing he does. Like, mm-hmm. there, you know, like there's a definite like willingness to be silly in these performances that are not like silly characters.
Well, you get to lean into it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the pleasure of Roxburgh's performance too, which I also love, is just like, okay, I am the bad guy, I'm the Duke, you know. So let me just really lay into these lines and give them a certain kind of comic flavor and just make myself the mustache twirling villain. Don't even try to make it more subtle than that, because I don't think it works otherwise. I think if you really play a role like that straight, then he becomes, you know, sinister in a very dark and disturbing way that's kind of that kind of doesn't really fit the tone of the movie.
I haven't seen every film in the Jim Broadbent filmography, but has he ever really had a chance to go anywhere near here again, or even before up to this point?
Maybe a little bit as Slughorn in the Harry Potter movies, but
yeah,
it's not nearly on this scale, you know.
Yeah, but,
like,
I don't
know. The introduction of that character, anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that he hasn't. I mean, in a way, you know, even his Mike Lee work. I mean, Mike Lee can play his films fairly big too. I mean, big in a much different way than Baz Luhrmann. But Jim Broadbent has been a, you know, is not the sort of actor who is sort of tucked into the woodwork. He's somebody who, you know, has a real presence. So, you know, whether mm-hmm. that presence is quite as outrageous as this one, I don't know. But I mean, like, you're talking about how many actors even get the opportunity to do this kind of work. It's a Baz Luhrmann film, you know. I mean, like, there's not a lot
enough.
Of, you know, I mean, I think we're probably gonna get to that when we get to Tom Hanks and Elvis. It's just like, you know, you kind of are able to go to places that you're not often able to go in other directors' work.
Just before we leave performances, I just want to note a couple of the, I guess, company members beyond John Leguizamo, specifically Jacek Komen as the unconscious Argentinian and Caroline O'Connor as Nini, specifically for the Roxanne Tango sequence. Although Nini also has a great moment when she is talking about the ending to the Duke, like, you know, tipping him off to what's happening. That's a good moment for her. But that tango sequence is another one I love. And it's primarily two background characters. I mean, obviously, Christian sings during it, but sort of the reveal of what this moment is, which it takes a minute for you to realize that they're doing Roxanne. I guess that's another song that's kind of sung more or less in its entirety, or it's not just a snippet anyway. But like when the Roxanne sequence started, when it's still just like the tango and the Argentinian is like speaking before he lays out the first Roxanne, I was like watching Steve. I'm like, I can't wait for him to see what this is going to be. Like, I was just like, you know, had my fingers together. That's just a fun one. And it's them, you know, they're the ones who pull it off.
Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned that one. I can't remember, what is the motive that she has for spilling the beans to the Duke? Why does she do that?
Yeah, I thought about that a little. And like, I guess one of the things that struck me on this watch is like, you know, we're kind of presented with the players of the Moulin Rouge is like this sort of community, this bohemian community, you know, but there actually doesn't seem to be a whole lot of like love or affection between them, at least not from Nini. And I think what it probably comes down to, just on a character motivation level, is like she sees what is happening with Satine and Christian and is pragmatic and realizes that like this could ruin everything for not just them, but her and everyone else at the Moulin Rouge, and she's pissed, and rightfully so. They're being a couple of idiots in love, you know. But I don't think it's, you know, pure malice.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe a little strange because the thing to do would just be hiding, you know, not revealing that information to the Duke. I think it would be just to kind of keep covering up for this secret relationship. But nevertheless, I don't want to get sidetracked by that, because I do really I like the Roxanne sequence quite a bit, also because it kind of gives you just a different mood, a different tone, you know, a presentation of that song that you don't expect, you know, because, you know, which is, you know, again, to the film's credit, I mean, you know, some of those kind of later, you know, musical sequence, the other one being like the Show Must Go On, you know, they have a different tone than at the beginning. I think things become heavier and more consequential toward the end as so much is on the line, and the movie's kind of able to, you know, shape shift accordingly, and also, you know, give you you know, new interpretations of these songs that sort of match, you know, the tone that the film's trying to hit.
It gets it right too. I mean, I feel like this is, you know, I kind of, you know, I don't know how big we want to get with it in terms of Lerman's career, but I feel like this is such a sweet spot for him in terms of the material matching the story, you know, type of film he likes to make. I mean, for me, there are moments in this movie that I watching this, like, this could only happen in a movie. When a film's doing something that really can only make sense in that medium, it's halfway there to winning me over anyway. And I think he really is kind of locked into doing some, you know, to pushing things in this film. And maybe people weren't quite in the mood for where he was always pushing them, or maybe he pushed too far and pushed in the wrong directions at times. But yeah, I'm left with a lot of admiration for the audaciousness of this film.
And he does it from the start. I mean, he can't even let the 20th Century Fox fanfare to play out without, mm-hmm, you know, messing with it a little bit.
I mean, there's an overture. It's a fast overture, you know, but
if he had fully brought back the overture, I would, you know, this would be complete, you know, masterpiece for me. I just, that would have been, bring back overtures and intermissions and things like that. I would love that.
I think also it's a good place for him to work in terms of where the effects are too, because the digital effects in this aren't totally convincing. They you know, if they were a little slicker, I don't think it would work nearly as well. I think that sort of element of artifice, even down, you know, when it comes to the special effects, is kind of key to how the film works in some ways.
So what issue do you have with them? Like the blurriness of?
Oh, I have no issue with it. No. I'm just saying that they're not entirely smooth. They're not entirely convincing. Yeah, it's a little janky at times, but I think that works for, you know, I don't know if it was intentional or the limitations of the effects in 2001. But it is, you know, the fact that the rough edges aren't shorn off kind of gives it even at its most digital kind of gives a kind of handmade quality, this film.
Well, I think if you turn the motion smoothing on your TV, it should straighten all of that out. It's not a problem for me when I watch it. My TV just corrects all that stuff.
Can you send me instructions on how to turn motion smoothing on, Scott? I could really use that.
Yeah, whatever weird thing it says you turn on instead of off, as you did when you purchased the thing and had to correct it. So, yeah, and I think you're right. One thing I would say, too, with regard to the, you know, kind of historical elements of the movie is that I don't think anyone cares. Right. I mean, like how, you know, you can just, you don't have to give a, you know, a credible history of the Moulin Rouge. You just have to engage with the idea of it. Like there's just certain elements of that place and what it represents and what it looked like, what it was kind of aesthetically. And like, you know, the kind of the whole Eiffel Tower thing, like it was all like, you could kind of just pick what you want. Throw the rest away and no one is going to raise a fuss, you know, which is, you know, not the case with a certain film that he made it in the year 2022. So I guess before we wrap up, I wanted to ask about the film's legacy, because it was a really kind of an unusual movie to see at the start of a summer, you know, a movie that Fox took a gamble on, put it right in the sweet, you know, right at the beginning of June, and was not a sequel or a reboot or anything like that. And it wasn't like all those other crappy summer movies that I had mentioned in the opening. I guess, what do you make of its legacy? And about, do you see it as kind of anomalous, or do you see it as influential on a lot of work that sort of has come about since?
I think like it's too idiosyncratic to be like super influential on like a filmmaking level, you know, like I don't know that there are a lot of, you know, up and coming directors who are like emulating Baz Luhrmann, just because like, why would you even try, mm-hmm. you know, but I do think like, to kind of go back to the point I made at the beginning about, you know, predicting so much of how we would consume culture and music, like I think it's influential on a broad pop cultural level specifically. And I think, you know, the fact that we did in 2018 get a new Broadway musical that won a buttload of Tonys, you know, and that people loved, you know, kind of speaks to there still being an audience for the story and this musical approach, even divorced from the filmmaking of Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it kind of does sort of fit into, you know, a broader movement to where people would accept a different way of making movies, a different way movies were being made, to where, you know, the editing in particular, you know, is there not necessarily to build suspense or establish time, you know, establish spatial relationships or these other things. It's really just about combining images in a way that they have an emotional effect, which is kind of a more of a music video thing than a necessarily something you would expect from a full length feature film.
I mean, it also, and sorry, just real quick, it also like anticipated Shuffle culture to a certain extent, you know, like this was basically like right before the iPod and right before iTunes and like our entire music collections could be called up in an instant and mixed up in any way we want, you know?
I'm sure if you did the research, you'd see a lot of people referring to it as a mixtape film at the time, or at least a couple people.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and also, would this movie be a hit in 2022 like it was in 2001?
I don't know what's
people
a hit.
Is it actually too far outside what people are used to seeing that they would be open to it, or what is it just such a irresistible you know, pop juggernaut that we'd go for it again.
I'll say this, because I don't like the "you couldn't make that movie today" discussion, because I feel like it's a little old. It makes me feel old, even though it's often as I feel that feeling. But I don't see its equivalent. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't see not only, you know, a groundbreaking musical of this sort, but anything that's this far outside the mold, playing, you know, released by a major studio in the middle of summer, the beginning of summer, as this one was, at least, to kick off the summer with this, you know.
At least Darren Aronofsky's Mother was not a summer movie release.
We're kind of about to find out if it would play in 2022 with Elvis, which is, I mean, obviously it's different, but it's really, really similar in a lot of ways, and most apparently in tone and filmmaking approach. But yeah, it's we're recording this like the day it hits theaters, so we don't yet know if audiences will respond, how audiences will respond to it, but I feel like this new movie is as close as we can get to the hypothetical of what if Moulin Rouge were released today.
Maybe so. We'll have to weigh in on that next week. We'll be back in a minute with some feedback. During our episode on Jurassic Park, we puzzled over the sequence involving a sick triceratops that Laura Dern's character, Ellie, examines shortly before a storm comes and all hell breaks loose at the park. Now someone has answers for us. Keith.
No, I don't have answers, but Charlie in Chicago has some answers. He wrote in and said, "The mystery of the sick triceratops is addressed in the book and supposedly in a scene in the movie that got filmed but was deleted. Triceratops don't have sufficient teeth to crush the plants they eat, so they would swallow piles of rough stones to help with breaking them up in their stomach. After a few weeks, the stones would smooth out too much and the triceratops would throw them up and swallow new ones. The guy in the movie mentions that the triceratops seemed to get sick every 6 weeks. When she would scoop up stones, she would unintentionally scoop up the West Indian lilac berries as well. But the berries would be regurgitated with the stones, hence why Ellie doesn't find them in the droppings. The more you know."
Yay.
And now we know.
Yeah, I will say that we did get a few people letting us know this detail that we puzzled over, but Charlie was first and gave the most detail. So thank you, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know what to say. Triceratops, that seems like a pretty unsustainable way of consuming food.
Yeah,
right?
I say Triceratops, get it together. Come on.
Yeah, come on.
Figure out a better way to consume your food.
So if it was filmed and deleted from the movie, like, is that a scene we want back in the movie? It was kind of the only dangling thread we talked about. I guess it depends, like, if there's more going on in the scene. But like, I'm curious what the filmed scene was that addressed that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it just becomes one thing too many. But then, of course, you know, you have this question, but I don't know, is the question that big, so much? I don't think you want to lose all the stuff with the triceratops, and certainly the plumbing through poop thing. You don't want to miss that either, or the character detail of her tending to this animal and all the stuff about them going. I mean, there are a lot of things that the scene accomplishes, you know, without necessarily answering all the questions we need answered about the triceratops. So, I mean, that's just movies. You gotta cut some stuff out, and that was maybe a painful cut. But I'd be curious to see it. It sounds like my cat does this, right? You choose a plant, throws up, you know, eats stuff it's not supposed to.
Is she eating stones?
Eats, well, I mean, maybe that would help if she had some small rough stones to swallow.
You know, I notoriously swallow cherry pits, and this is why.
Wow. Don't do that. Genevieve, wait! I recall you ate an apple with the core. You
do that.
You do that though.
I don't always do it, but the core doesn't.
You can
taste
eat the core.
Especially good, but yeah, you can eat it.
The core is relative too. I mean, you know, after you know,
yeah, it's relevant you can to define... like put a core through and then throw in the garbage.
I mean, I don't eat the apple cores.
Throw in the compost, Scott.
I have to see if I could, you know. I mean, we watched that movie Swallow. We know what it's all about, you know. Sometimes you just got to eat things to see if you can.
All right. Well, so on that note, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations and things that they like to ingest. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at Elvis, Baz Luhrmann's bedazzled biopic about the king of rock and roll. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, Adam from Film Spotting has demanded that we dump the penniless sitar player we love and take up with the Maharaja. Christina. Line.